Astonishing Grace to the Chief of All Fools by Michael Criswell. Chapter 4. Network Marketing, Motivational Speaking, Jail, and a Car Accident. Before my first real job, I was that simple-minded kid who mowed lawns and washed cars to earn my money. I remember the satisfaction and dignity I would feel upon receiving a nice, crisp $20 bill in my hands after several hours of hard work detailing someone's car in the hot sun. I took pride in my work, and I couldn't wait to buy something nice with my hard-earned money. I got my first real job in 1988 while attending the ninth grade of high school in Cocoa Beach, Florida. I worked at a seafood restaurant in Port Canaveral called Captain Ed's. I was a busboy, cleaning all the dirty dishes off the tables, and even doing some dishwashing in the kitchen from time to time. The most memorable and ironic highlight from that job came one evening when a woman found a pearl in one of her oysters. As she was digging it out, it shot out and fell under the table somewhere. I volunteered to help them find it. I grabbed a flashlight and I climbed under their table, searching through all the crumbs and leftover food particles that end up under busy restaurant tables. I looked everywhere and went back and forth several times, confident it had to be under there, but I couldn't find it. I crawled out from under the table so disappointed, and so was she. Just as I was about to say I'm sorry and walk away, I wondered if it could have possibly fallen behind her seat cushion and into the wooden cabinet that it sits on. I pulled up her seat cover, and there it was. A fine pearl indeed. Everyone was so happy, and the guests and employees standing around all started clapping. The lady was so appreciative that she gave me a $20 bill for finding it. It was exciting to see someone find a pearl in their oyster, but to me, that $20 was more valuable than the pearl was because it gave me the ability to quickly satisfy my desires. I cannot help but seeing that as an illustration of how for so many years I found much more value and pleasure in money than I did in searching for and finding the pearl of great price, which I now have. Money can provide an instant benefit, whereas the pearl of great price takes a great deal of time and sacrifice to be found and cultivated into something valuable. Matthew 13:45-46. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. My second job is where I got my very first exposure to sales. It was during the summer of 1989 in Highlands, North Carolina. I had just finished up the last 6 months of my 10th grade year at Edgewater High School in Orlando, Florida. I moved with my mother and my new stepfather to this very small but wealthy mountain town where I was supposed to start the 11th grade. I had moved in with them over the Christmas break of my 10th grade year after I got kicked out of my dad's house in Cape Canaveral, Florida. I had discovered my stepmother's longtime cocaine addiction, and I had been rebelling against her, even to the point of running away from home one time. That summer in Highlands, I took a part-time job at a local Oriental rug dealer called Shiraz Oriental Rug Company. I helped with various tasks around the store, like cleaning and moving the rugs around, but I found myself very interested in becoming knowledgeable about the rugs so that I too could talk to the customers like an expert. My broken childhood left me with a strong desire to feel valuable. I couldn't consciously understand it or see it at the time, but I was driven at a deep level to find the human love and acceptance I once had and lost. I would listen in when the owners, two brothers from Iran, were explaining about the different countries, fabrics, knot counts, and ages of the rugs to the customers. The more I learned about them, the more I wanted to be able to share my knowledge with the customers. John 12:43. For they loved praise from men more than praise from God. Soon, they began allowing me to show some of the rugs to customers, and I did so with a great deal of enthusiasm. To see someone buy something very expensive, which you have recommended, was a great thrill and mental high for me, which felt incredible. My stepfather was a self-made millionaire in a business he created to match high-caliber employees with large companies. He told me emphatically one day that I only had three choices for a career. He said I could either be an actor, a lawyer, or a salesperson. That statement planted a seed in my mind and was a catalyst in my career choices for years to come. Now, with my first small taste of sales at Shiraz, I found myself being excited and fulfilled. Soon, I knew more about the rugs than most of the people coming in. Because the rugs were perceived as being valuable, my knowledge of them made me feel valuable. The highlight of this job was when they let me do a small stitch repair on a very old Persian rug worth over $40,000. I smile when I look back and see how important these kind of things were to me as a young man. I had a good heart, but I was all flesh and natural instinct. By the time I got through college, I had a variety of other jobs. I spent 2 summers working as a laborer in home construction, and I was a floor guard at a skating rink. I even spent a few weeks saying, "Welcome to the border, may I take your order?" at a Taco Bell drive-thru in Cullman, Alabama, until I landed a job loading the UPS trucks at the Hartsel, Alabama Distribution Center. Then, in the summer of 1992, I sold surfboards and sunglasses at Ron John Surf Shop in Cocoa Beach, Florida. This is where I met Jennifer, who also worked there but who wouldn't have anything to do with me for another year. I committed 2 terrible sins while working at Ron John's that didn't fully register at the time because of my carnality and my denial. An attractive girl I worked with started talking to me in very flirtatious ways, making sexual innuendos to me, even though she was married. I was already a joker, and I didn't take her very seriously at first, but she kept pursuing me. She told me she was married, but that her husband was in the military and was stationed somewhere else for a time. She spoke openly about the marriage being a mistake and saying he was a drunk who had abused her often. I was only 19 years old, and my flesh was stirred up and enticed by its evil desires. That's when I think I justified in my mind that their marriage didn't really count because they were married so young and because he had been abusive to her. She persisted in flirting with me, and I eventually gave in to her flirtatiousness and had an adulterous relationship with her for several weeks. I think it was probably a few years before I came out of my denial and fully realized my guilt and shame of adultery. I wonder how many terrifying moments of condemnation I felt over several years, all so I could temporarily gratify the evil desires of my flesh. Proverbs 5:3-5. For the lips of an adulteress drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil. But in the end, she is bitter as gall, sharp as a double-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lead straight to the grave. This wasn't my only sin while working at Ron John's. I also used my employee discount to help a friend buy some clothes for himself, which was against company policy. Just as I had justified the affair in my mind, I now justified my employee theft as being no big deal because the store was doing $40 million in annual sales and I was only trying to help a friend save a little money. It's no surprise when heathens live like this, but it's a terrible shame that I was doing these things while thinking I was a saved Christian. After that came the job I had in Huntsville, Alabama, selling Filter Queen vacuum cleaners door to door. I consider this to be my first real sales job. It was 100% commission with an intense sales environment focused on motivating us to earn more money. This is also where I got my first taste of cold calling. We would be dropped off in neighborhoods, each carrying a 40-pound demo kit. We could either walk around and melt in the heat or figure out how to get someone to accept a small gift to let us in to do our sales pitch. We called it getting knocked in. And I had no idea of the amazing high I was about to experience doing this in spite of my fears of rejection. To walk up to a complete stranger's house, knock on their door, get them to invite me in their home, and then walk out 90 minutes later with a check for nearly $1,500 was absolutely thrilling. It gave me a feeling of power in my life, which I had never known so far. Making a sale like this and earning several hundred dollars in commission gave me such an adrenaline rush. Also, there was the tremendous praise from the owner and office staff about my sales abilities. This was the exact type of love and acceptance my wounded soul was so hungry for. I loved watching my sales units climb on the company board for everyone to see. Soon it was no longer about just making a good income. It was about the pride of being the top salesperson and about securing all the love and adoration for myself. I quickly became the top salesperson in the Southeast United States and was recognized in the industry newsletter. I was consistently earning about $1,200 to $1,500 per week at 19 years old. I bought myself a new car, loaded it with an obnoxious custom stereo system, and because I was an independent contractor, I was taking week-long vacations each month to go back down to Florida. I ran back into and started dating Jennifer on one of those trips where I had gone down to buy the dirt bike. After dating long distance for 6 months, I went back to Florida and moved in with her to see if she was the one I was supposed to marry. I first moved into Jennifer's Cape Canaveral apartment sometime around March of 1994. I still considered myself a Christian, but the fire I once had for Christ back in the 10th grade had been choked off by all the other cares in this world. I don't remember attending church anywhere, and I wasn't reading the Bible. For quite a while, I didn't even have a job, and Jennifer had to help me make some of my car payments. This was embarrassing to me after the income I had been making just a year earlier. And the pressure to find a nice income and prove my worth became great. One time, I signed up for an offer on TV that if you come to this conference, you can get a guaranteed government job with all these great benefits and pay. I paid a bunch of money, only to later find out we had been scammed. I was humiliated. I still had the same dirt bike which I had come down to buy in Florida almost 2 years earlier. I cleaned it up and kept it in the empty dining room of this second-story condo we were now living in. Even though we had so many troubles in our relationship and in building a life, I remember feeling so happy when I would walk in and just see that dirt bike sitting in the house. It made me feel like everything was going to be okay. I even had Jennifer take pictures of me sitting on it while it was in the house, like it was some kind of a beloved family member. I would often go down and lust over the new model motorcycles at the Beach Sport Cycles Yamaha dealership in Cocoa, Florida. A happy future life for me at the time would have been one where I'd go riding every weekend, and a dream life would have been one where one day I owned my own private motocross track. I almost never stopped thinking about it, and I loved it with all my heart. My spiritual eyes were blinded to the disgusting idolatry that was in my heart. I had such a strong emotional attachment to motocross because I associated it with having a father figure in my life and feeling like I was a man, and also the protection it gave me from the bullies as a vulnerable teenager. In a very real way, that dirt bike had felt like a savior to me, and it had become a false god to save me from my troubles. 1 John 2:15-17. Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For everything in the world, the cravings of sinful man, the lust of his eyes, and the boasting of what he has and does, comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires pass away, but the man who does the will of God lives forever. I am so ashamed of looking back on how I lived while considering myself a believer in Jesus Christ and worthy of eternal life. I was completely blinded by my love of money and the world system which Satan rules over. Going to the motorcycle dealership and buying something felt to me what I might imagine going to the bar feels like for an alcoholic. I hung around the dealership enough that eventually they offered me a job working on the weekends, where I sold motorcycles and personal watercraft. After this, I had a job for about 6 months selling telephone headsets over the phone. I really didn't like the job and was fired due to poor performance. After that, I got a job selling car stereo systems at what was once a major Florida electronics retailer called Sound Advice. The job was part salary and part commission, and I was regularly one of the top mobile electronics salespeople. But the money was never enough for me after having tasted the higher commissions of selling those vacuums. Sadly, I even remember being envious of one of my customers who could buy whatever he wanted after being electrocuted while working construction on a new Walmart and receiving a large settlement. I remember thinking how lucky he was to have had the accident and then to have gotten all that money. What I felt in my heart for money was nothing short of lust from God's perspective. Ecclesiastes 5:10. Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless. I was convinced that if I could just figure out how to make more money, Jennifer would see me as a good provider and we could both be happy. As a professing Christian, I was about to start heading further and further in the wrong direction and towards becoming enslaved by the money god. Hebrews 13:5. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have, because God has said, "Never will I leave you, never will I forsake you." I was earning a decent paycheck at Sound Advice, but I was not content, and neither was Jennifer. And that's why I was so susceptible when one of my customers told me about a network marketing company they were making a bunch of money in. This became a crossroads in my life, where I had a choice between contentment or chasing after just a little bit more money. Someone once said, "How much money is enough? Just a little bit more." In spite of the fact that just a year or two earlier, I swore I would never join another MLM after our first experience with Amway, here I was signing up for another one because I loved money and was never content. This becomes the starting point of a life pierced with so many griefs that I would give anything if I could go back to myself in my early 20s and say, "Please, I beg you, listen to me, young man. I have lived your life and there's a much, much better way." I want you to read this passage in 1 Timothy and meditate on it every day for the next month, asking God to give you understanding and the ability to heed its warnings. I can tell you with absolute certainty that this is exactly what is about to start happening in your life. But you have a choice, and it doesn't have to be this way if you choose wisely. 1 Timothy 6, 6-10. "But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. People who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people, eager for money, have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. The wise choice would have clearly been to seek godliness with contentment. But I can see that I needed to learn about my foolishness and God's mercy by difficult experience. I believe I was so stubborn and so determined that he needed to just let me go and have the firsthand experience of taking my mental and emotional inheritance and seeing what kind of life I could make for myself with it. I needed to be free to go prodigal. The network marketing company was called STS, Strategic Telecom Systems. They sold customized prepaid phone cards and had created a huge collector trade from limited edition phone cards. I was told that the founders were Christians, and between that and the "this isn't about money, this is about helping other people" spiel, I had enough justification in my conscience to do it again. Soon I was attending local meetings at the Crealdi Business Center in Winter Park, Florida, where I met David Bartels, a very passionate and articulate presenter of the STS business plan. I was drawn to David because of his humor and enthusiasm, and more importantly, because he had money. David and I hit it off well, and he in turn introduced me to George Boomer. George was a retired car dealer who lived in a huge house and who once owned Magic Isuzu, the largest Isuzu dealership in the country. And David was still a top-producing sales manager at Courtesy Auto Group. Both of them were already financially successful, and yet they were really excited about this MLM company. I was drawn to them both because I thought if I just hung around them, I could learn how to make a lot of money like them. I wanted to be their disciples because clearly they knew how the money god worked. George put a great deal of focus on the collector card side of the business. So I too started buying hundreds of collectible cards and going to trade shows with him to sell them. The money started flowing in immediately and I was hooked. It was so easy and I was having so much fun buying and selling the cards that it almost became like what a gambling high must feel like. I just kept dreaming about all the money I was going to make from this and how happy Jennifer and I would be with all the new things we could buy and do. I kept buying more and more cards, and of course, I never thought it would end until it did. STS ended up being found guilty of some type of fraud, and suddenly I had thousands of dollars in phone cards that were all worthless. After several years of keeping them in a closet, just hoping I could maybe sell them one day, I finally had to throw them all in the garbage. Proverbs 13:11 NLT. Wealth from get-rich-quick schemes quickly disappears. Wealth from hard work grows over time. My hopes for lasting peace with Jennifer were gone too. She came right back at me and started blaming me once again for all the loss and the strained finances we were now again facing. I started feeling so hopeless and desperate for a sense of direction that one day I broke down and called one of the psychic hotlines that were being advertised on the TV. I praise God that I cannot remember a single word that woman said to me, because by doing that, I was knocking on the devil's door and saying, "Hey, I need some answers for my life, Satan." Oh, how I thank God that he overlooked so much of my spiritual ignorance and darkness. However, all hope was not lost for long, because soon after the network marketing company fell apart, David called and offered me another job. He was going on the road to promote and sell seminar tickets for a very successful sales trainer in the automobile business. David assured me that with proper training, I would be great at this and could make a bunch of money and more than recover my losses from the phone cards. I was nervous about quite a few things, but I was anxious to get back up and make a bunch of money to prove myself. Motivational indoctrination. David had recruited several other people to join the team, and the owner/speaker flew in for an introduction to himself and his company so we could decide if we wanted to be a part of it. He was the most charismatic, intelligent, well-read, confident, outspoken, motivational, and successful person I had ever met in my young life. I was absolutely blown away by this guy's passion, success, and his motivational vision of getting people to live and work at what he called a level 10 life. He showed us flyers of him sharing the stage with other famous speakers like Coach Lou Holtz and Ken Blanchard. He told us all kinds of incredible and inspirational stories, like how his football dreams were shattered in his very first game as the starting quarterback for LSU football team because a linebacker hit his knee so hard that even after 5 surgeries, he could never play again. Or the story of when he was asked to give the championship-winning Chicago Bulls team a pep talk before one of their winning games, and that Dennis Rodman was so pumped up that he thought he was going to start taking notes on himself. He even passed around a book full of photocopied 5-figure checks from car dealerships all over the country who he had done training for. Then he gave us all copies of the book he wrote about the life lessons his grandfather had taught him every morning when he was young. And most importantly, he spoke about his wife and kids and about God. I thought to myself, wow! Here's a successful man who has millions, and he's also a Christian. This could be such a wonderful opportunity for me to be successful by learning from him, a real godsend. After leaving his meeting that day at the hotel, I stepped into the elevator and found myself standing with Whitney Houston and Bobby Brown. I was certainly surprised to meet them, but honestly, it didn't have near the impact on me that I thought it would because I was still on such a high after listening to this man speak all day. I couldn't stop thinking about how successful I was going to be. I was going to get to work for a successful speaker and motivator, and I wanted so badly to be around him and to be mentored by him. I was so excited to be a part of this company, and I loved the idea of traveling and living in some new city every 2 months. We planned our first workshop as a new team right in Central Florida, and we all did 2 weeks of intense role play and training at David's house. As a salesperson and trainer, I had to be able to cold call a car dealer over the phone, secure an in-person appointment, and then sell him not only on the idea of letting me conduct his next sales meeting, but also commit to paying a portion of the $695 tickets for each salesperson whom I could get to commit to attending the 2-day workshop. The sales teams all lived together in corporate apartments in each new city we did a workshop in. We pumped each other up, and the atmosphere was always charged with greed, competition, and the love of money. This is when I really started becoming more and more indoctrinated by the motivational and success training philosophy. I filled my mind with the best programs on sales training, goals, money making, time management, and life success. Everything I listened to was about being the master of my own destiny and creating the happy dream life I really loved and wanted. I did not yet understand that the direction I was heading was in complete contradiction to the teachings of Jesus Christ, the one whom I claimed to believe in. John 12:25. The man who loves his life will lose it, while the man who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. I learned all the principles of being quote-unquote successful, including how to justify your new greedy and money-loving life by giving back and helping others along the way so you feel fulfilled. One of the wealthiest, money-loving, quote-unquote Christians I know started an orphanage in Central America and did quite a bit of good after making tens of millions in network marketing. It all looked and sounded so loving and giving from the speaking platform to audiences filled with people that wanted his lifestyle. And I'm sure it helped ease his conscience about pursuing more and more money. But when you get close to these people behind the scenes, the real treasure and master of their heart becomes crystal clear. In my new job, I got so good at cold calling that I was getting twice as many appointments as the other guys. I had practiced, drilled, and rehearsed so much that no matter what the dealer said to me, I was able to keep them moving forward. I had several dealers give up on telling me no and start laughing because they were so impressed by my phone skills. With each new appointment and sale, my confidence and income was growing, and so was my hellish pride. The same thing happened in my sales meetings at the dealerships. I eventually became so good at conducting sales meetings that my closing percentages were again breaking company records, and many dealers tried to hire me on the spot. I was receiving more and more of my value by how well I could perform in sales. The money was getting better and better. But I now noticed Jennifer was starting to feel anxious about her own career and income. She had a bachelor's degree in organizational psychology with honors, and it was going to waste. She had worked in retail for a few years, and then, believe it or not, she went to work for a door-to-door vacuum cleaner company called Kirby in Melbourne, Florida. She tried the in-home sales side of the business and made a few sales, but she ended up back in the office in a more administration/sales support position. She was always left wanting more. She craved a position in leadership, and I could see she was jealous of my being on the road and being around the larger business atmosphere. We had all kinds of arguments, and more than once, I came home to a phone book open to the pages of divorce attorneys. I started seeing what I called wild business oats that I knew she needed to sow, and I saw she was fully determined to find some type of leadership position in business. She couldn't be talked into being content any more than I could at the time. I don't remember the details of how and when it actually happened. But at some point, the speaker I was working for offered Jennifer a position doing some administrative type work for him from our home. I was excited that she was now going to have a sense of fulfillment, knowing she was doing something in the business world. She became happy being a part of this guy's company, even though it was just admin and sales support type work to begin with. I remained on the road, and my sales success and income was increasing with each workshop. I think because of my insecurities as a child, I began to also love the feeling of power that this was giving me. My whole life, I had felt powerless against the bullies, poverty, and my life circumstances. And now I was being able to walk into a sales meeting as a 23-year-old kid and get the old car dogs, as they call them, the guys who've been selling cars longer than I had been alive, to buy a $695 ticket to a sales workshop. Many times, I sold tickets to the sales guys that managers said could never be sold. The high of a nice paycheck didn't even seem to match the feeling of having this kind of power and this sense of being valued by others. The man we were promoting began to pay closer attention to me and spending more time with me in each city we moved to. He started honoring me on a regular basis in front of the other team members. One time he said, "Criswell, you have more natural talent for this than any person I've ever met. I'm going to make you a superstar, Criswell. You are going to be a huge success, and I'm going to have you conducting workshops one day on your own." My heart fluttered with excitement and joy. Not too long after he said this, we were doing a workshop in Baltimore, Maryland, when he surprised me and came up to me on a break and told me he was going to allow me to teach a part of the class after the lunch break. Again, I was so nervous, but I got up on that stage and I was absolutely hooked. This is when I got what is known in the business as speaker fever. No other experience in my life could compare to the feeling I got when standing on that stage before an audience of hundreds who had paid $695 to attend. And then whatever I told them to do, they did. It gave me a sense of power and control that had been missing in my life for so long. Perhaps just like a heroin addict after his first use, I couldn't wait for my next hit. However, starting from the very first seminar, I had started to see some red flags and hear some things that made me question the high position I had been holding this guy in. He was so powerful on that stage that all of us on the sales team would sit back and watch him, totally mesmerized by how he commanded the platform and the audience. To this day, I have never met a more dynamic speaker or powerful personality than this man. I used to say and still believe that this guy was more passionate and more talented on the stage than even Tony Robbins. He was that good, and yet he was constantly needing more adulation from us. This guy was so impressive that I even started feeling like a junior celebrity just being around him. I was so proud of him as my boss, and my insecure heart loved that others would think more highly of me because of my association with him. That's why what happened at the end of each day's workshop was so puzzling to me. After he dismissed the class, he would always come to us feigning humility and apologizing profusely to us for not doing a very good job. Then we would all start saying, "What in the world are you talking about? That was absolutely amazing. You killed it." What he was doing was so powerful that we all often joked saying things like, "You really put them in the ether," or "You had them really drinking the Kool-Aid, boss." Sadly, our carnally minded reference to Kool-Aid was a reference to Jim Jones. Jim Jones was best known as the cult leader of the People's Temple, who had led more than 900 followers in a mass suicide via cyanide-laced punch known as the Jonestown Massacre. My boss could make an entire room of car sales guys cry and get them to do things in public which most of them would never be caught doing sober. But our praise of him was never enough. And even as a terribly insecure 23-year-old kid, I felt something was wrong in that he had this strong need for constant feedback and praise. There were several things like this that I had noticed from a distance. But as he started allowing me in his circle more and more, I started seeing compromises and character flaws that weren't becoming of the messages he preached to audiences. He had a beautiful wife and baby daughter in his then second marriage. But I started hearing stories about him sleeping with several members of his office staff and of families that had been broken up by this man's manipulation, sexual scandals, and his love for money and power. There were rumors circulating that he was lying about most of his story, and big things like having owned a dealership and sold it for millions and having played as a quarterback for LSU. I think I just kept hoping that if I looked away from what I didn't want to see, these things would all just go away or he would change. I had so much admiration for him and the life he had built, and I felt a strong affection for him as my boss and mentor. After all, this was the man who saw something special in me and who said he was going to turn me into a superstar. If these rumors turned out to be true, my dreams and hopes of him helping me be successful would be crushed. So I just kept moving forward, hoping it would all go away. Instead of going away, I was about to see something with my own eyes that shattered my image of this man and ultimately shattered my confidence in my own discernment of others. While we were doing a workshop in Washington, D.C., he took me out all by myself to a restaurant in Old Town Alexandria, Virginia, called 219 Restaurant. I was so excited to get more one-on-one time with him. While we were sitting there, an attractive woman came and sat down all by herself about two tables down from us. Naturally, we said hello, but he used his unbelievable charisma and engaged her in further conversation and got her laughing and talking to us about who we were and what we did. She seemed fascinated by it, and they exchanged cards. Eventually, he and I finished our dinner, said goodbye to the lady as we walked by, and started walking back to his hotel, which was just up the street. Once we got back to his hotel, I got in my rental car and started heading back to our corporate apartment, but then I realized I forgot to get something from his hotel room, and I headed back. On my way, I ran into that woman on the way to his hotel room. I said hello and realized she was looking for him. This made me really upset because he was married and I now knew something terrible was going on. The next day at a meeting with the sales team, he started telling the story of us meeting this lady and then went on and on laughing and telling everyone, "She came back to the hotel looking for Criswell. Criswell, that woman had the hots for you, young man. She was after you." I knew in that moment he was trying to cover up the fact that I saw her in the hotel on her way to his hotel room and that he was being unfaithful to his wife. I was devastated and crushed. I had been so naive to believe this man was some kind of a saint and that God was going to use him to help me be successful. Now I knew without any doubt that my hero was a fraud, an adulterer, and a hypocrite. All of his talk about God, family, doing good to others, and living a purposeful level 10 life now meant absolutely nothing. At first, I was so angry and so hurt that I thought about just packing up and leaving. But then my fear of failure kicked in, and so did my pride. I didn't want to admit that I had been such a naive fool or have to walk away from all the hard work I put towards trying to prove I could measure up and be successful. Plus, I didn't want to walk away from the income. This is when I started consciously compromising what little spiritual light I had because of my love of money and my even greater fear of failing in something again. I was now starting to live the life of a hypocrite, and I was on the same despised path to hell that I knew he was on. This is where, in God's mercy, he reached out to afflict me in two significant ways to get me back on the path of living by the convictions I already had. Job 33, 14, 16, 18, and 29 through 30. For God does speak. He may speak in their ears and terrify them with warnings, to turn man from wrongdoing and keep him from pride, to preserve his soul from the pit, his life from perishing by the sword. God does all these things to a man twice, even three times, to turn back his soul from the pit, that the light of life may shine on him. I had also gotten my best friend at the time, Brent Dixon, a job working for this guy as well. On March 1st, 1997, we were both off the road and at home with our wives for a week-long break. Jennifer and I were living in Merritt Island, Florida at the time, and Brent and his wife were coming over from Orlando to go to the beach with us. I jumped on my 600cc Yamaha sport motorcycle, which I hadn't ridden in weeks, and went for a quick ride to our bank in Cocoa Beach. It was a gorgeous spring day, and I was feeling so great. On the way home, I rode a wheelie down the 520 Causeway on my way back to Merritt Island. When I set the front wheel down, I accelerated quickly to over 100 miles per hour. Just as I let off the gas, I noticed a highway patrol car at the entrance to Kiwanis Island Park looking right at me. he immediately turned around and came after me. In a panic, I started racing to get away from him. Unfortunately, running away was my first instinct because 1 year earlier, I was on my way home from Orlando one night after a long day of work. I was exhausted and had a 1 hour ride home on my motorcycle. It was raining and I was starting to fall asleep from the hum and the vibration of the warm engine. I was desperate to get home quickly and there was almost no cars on the highway, so I decided to accelerate to over 120 miles per hour down the 528 beach line to shorten up the road. Just as I was nearing Cocoa, Florida, a police officer flipped on his lights on the other side of the highway. I knew he was going to have a hard time getting turned around because of the big median, and it had just stopped raining, so I decided to run. On a motorcycle that will do over 150 miles per hour, it was so easy to get away, and I knew there was no way he was going to catch me. I got off the highway at the next exit and made it home safely. It was so easy to get away that when I saw this next set of blue lights, my instinct was to just run again. This time, I raced ahead and tried to hide in a nearby neighborhood. I was so scared from running that my body was shaking all over, and I knew I was going to wreck if I didn't get off that motorcycle. I found a street that dead-ended at a canal, and I pulled my motorcycle up behind a bush, took off my helmet, and just sat down by the water. I tried to calm myself down, and I started praying and asking God to please forgive me and to help me out of this because I knew I had really messed up and done something very wrong. After about 10 minutes, the fear from hiding was so bad that I could no longer just keep sitting there. The anxiety caused by my hiding started to feel worse than if I would have just got caught. I decided to get back on my motorcycle and slowly ride out of the neighborhood. Unknown to me, he was riding around the neighborhood very slowly, listening for me to start it back up because it had a loud exhaust pipe on it. I made it less than a half a block, and here he came around the corner. He raced over in front of me, jerked me off the bike, threw my $600 helmet on the road, and put me in handcuffs. I recall being told it had become a felony to flee and evade a police officer just 1 month before I did this. He was so angry that I had ran from him, and he threw me in the front seat of his car with my hands cuffed behind my back. While driving down the road, he said in a loud and stern voice, "You just made a big mistake, pal, a huge one. I hope you weren't planning on doing anything good with your life because you are going to jail for a long time. Your life is ruined now, pal, and I'm going to make sure of that. You picked the wrong guy to run from today, buddy." I was in disbelief that this was happening. I really felt like I had just ruined my life. I even started crying because I was so afraid. Ironically, on the way to jail, we came up to the intersection of Courtney Boulevard and the 528 beach line. While we were sitting at the light, I saw my friend Brent and his wife turning right in front of us, smiling and laughing as they were on their way to my house and to have a wonderful day at the beach. The officer's window was down, so I yelled out to them, but they couldn't hear me. I was so scared when we reached the jail, and especially when they put me in that holding pen with drug dealers and thugs. One of the guys in there was looking for some paper so he could smoke some weed he had smuggled in his buttocks. I couldn't believe it. This guy had no fear or respect for the law or the jail he was in. I started thinking, what in the world have I gotten myself into? I was even more afraid walking into the main cell area as the new guy among all those men in that jail. But then I became the best actor I had ever been. I put on a tough guy face and changed the tone of my voice to cover over how afraid I was. I even acted a little rebellious towards the unfair law, even though I was 100% guilty. The first thing everyone wants to know in jail is what you're in for. So naturally, I tried to make my running from the officer sound much more dramatic than it was. I was a skinny little 23-year-old guy, and there was some big, scary-looking men in there. I got bunked with a smaller guy about my size who was in jail because he had beat up his girlfriend. All of the jokes from high school about not dropping the soap were no longer funny, and I was way too terrified to go near that shower area. When I received my first meal that first night, it really hit me that I was in jail. There was something so humiliating about grabbing my meal on a tray through that little crack in the door and realizing I was no longer considered a regular part of society. The normal people were outside, and I was now among convicted criminals and being fed like a dangerous animal in a cage. I sat down to eat dinner that first meal, and it was just like in the movies. This big guy sitting right across from me pointed to my roll and said,
"You gonna eat that?"
Needless to say, I had lost my appetite for my roll, and I gave it to him right away. I was able to make one phone call to Jennifer, and she called our boss, who tried to get a bail bondsman to get me out. But no one would get out of bed at 2 a.m. for such a small amount of money. The next morning, I appeared before the judge, whereupon, looking at my record, he looked at me, and with a huge grimace on his face, he said, "Son, what in the world are you doing in here before me today?" I explained to him that I had panicked and I had made a huge mistake. He saw I had no criminal record whatsoever and let me go on pretrial intervention. I got out of jail that afternoon and was ordered to pay a monthly fine at a meeting with a pretrial officer once a month for 9 months. This event really shocked my system, but apparently it wasn't enough. So God was going to allow another affliction to occur right around the corner. Not even 2 months later, in May of 1997, the vice president of the company, Tony Pate, and I were headed to do a big sales meeting at a large dealership in Baltimore, Maryland. He had just gotten into town, and we were on the way to the appointment in my Toyota Camry rental car. While I was driving, we got into a debate over the directions. We didn't have Google Maps or GPS back then, so we were looking at a little plastic map I had in the car. Somewhere just before the North I-95 exit to the Baltimore-Washington airport, the road started turning slightly to the right, and because I was looking at the map in his hands, I drifted into the left lane, and in my blind spot was an 18-wheeler. What happened next was horrifying. Our car got sucked against that big front tire and wheel well, and the next thing I know, Tony and I were being pulled sideways over in front of that 18-wheeler, driving 65 miles an hour down the highway. The rental car was now completely sideways, being pushed down the interstate, and my face was 6 inches from the grill of the truck. The car was shaking so violently, and I was panicked, realizing this was going to be bad. The weight of the truck was caving in the side of the car, and I had a death grip on the steering wheel, and I felt like I had pushed the brake pedal through the floor. The noise was unbelievable, with all the metal screeching and all four tires on the car being shredded and blown. And as the car was bouncing up and down in front of the truck, we were moving forward towards the left side of the truck until finally it kicked us free and we spun like 2 360s in the middle of 6 lanes of traffic in the center of I-95. We spun over and slammed against the guardrail with me being trapped in. The police and ambulance were there within minutes. A female police officer reached in and gave me her bottle of Pepsi to drink until they could get us out of the car. She said, "You better take a picture of this young man because it's a miracle you guys are alive. Many times when this happens, the car ends up under the trailer or under those back wheels back there." Tony and I were both taken to the hospital and we both suffered from muscle soreness and whiplash, but we didn't have a scratch on us. I woke up the next morning in our corporate apartment in shock and literally started yelling, "I'm alive! I'm alive! Thank you, God, I got another chance. After the gratitude of being alive passed, I went into a deep sadness, realizing that my life was looking like it was cursed. I was having troubles in my marriage. My income and career goals were just shattered after realizing my boss was a fraud. I went to jail after running from the police, and now I've just been in a terrible accident with an 18-wheeler. I remember dropping to my knees in my room and asking God for forgiveness. I told him that my life wasn't working well with me being in control, and I wanted to do life his way and with his help. It was a very humbling season, and it got me back standing firm on my values and living up to the light I had at the time. David Bartels, who got me this job, had been working on a different team from mine and doing parallel workshops in other cities. He too had already seen enough monkey business and left the company and went back home to Orlando. At some point, he told me about another job opportunity he had for me if I was interested, but I stayed on board to finish the Baltimore workshop, and then we all moved to Chicago for the next workshop. By the time the Chicago workshop was over, they had changed my pay plan a few more times, which was now 10 times in less than a year. This became the straw that broke the camel's back, and I told David I was interested in talking to him about the job offer because I was ready to leave. Even after all the lies, the hypocrisy, and the broken promises I had seen in the owner of the company, it was still a very sad and emotional day when I sat down and told him and Tony Pate that I was quitting. All of us had tears in our eyes, and they asked if there was anything that could be done to keep me from leaving. I told them firmly the decision was already made. Jennifer decided to stay working for the company, and I reluctantly agreed to it since she was doing more office-type work and because she was now the only one of us with a paying job. Things were soon going to change, though, and the seeds of adultery were already being planted by the predator I had once looked up to as a saint.